All right. It's time for another episode of The Fifth Estate. After a week off, Ben Howe and I are back. Ben is here. Right, Ben?
Thank you very much. I'm very grateful that you gave me a week's vacation. the wages that this job pays, I really need them.
I know. We're loaded up. And the news gal is back. Andrea Ruth is back.
I am.
Yeah, after a long absence.
This time from Iran, where we're getting ready to launch some missiles at unsuspecting Americans.
Yeah. I enjoy that it didn't take you 37 seconds to reply to Jason.
Well, you know, Iran actually has some fairly, modern technology given the billions of dollars that we gave them a couple years ago, thanks to Obama. So you can thank Obama for my excellent response time in Iran.
I thank Obama for all kinds of things.
I'm sure you do.
Yeah. We also have a guest this week after being without a guest for a few episodes there. Everybody knows her more than probably the rest of us. Bridget Fantasy is with us this week. Hello there.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm great.
All right.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you. If I didn't hear you, you would have been like, hi. And I would have been like, hello, you there? So I can hear you.
I just mean, can you hear me well?
Yeah. No, it's all good. It's all good. Okay, so
California sounds worse than Iran these days.
Yeah, well, California is. It's like, it's a socialist landscape.
Yeah, it's ruled by Soviets and stuff, and they've got net neutrality over there, and Bridget lives there.
Yeah. I'm being throttled.
And then if you go to San Francisco, they go nothing but shit all over the place.
Right.
It's just a wonderful place to live.
Toxic air.
Highest poverty rate.
Yeah, everybody's getting high off their own parts.
Oh, but Washington State was ranked the top state in the country. So I said the other day, you just have to ignore all the homeless and ignore the fact that the only affordable housing is up in the mountains and not where any jobs are. And you have to ignore the grinding poverty next to extreme wealth up in the woods. So
who said that Washington State was the number one state?
I don't know. Some national.
Those things that, and I was telling somebody this the other day. It's like these magazines that choose like the best places to live. It's like the writers or the editor, they must get paid, because I told you, somebody else too, Money Magazine, like, X amount of years ago, said that Gainesville, Florida was like the best place to live in America. Now, unless you are a Florida Gator, unless you have any kind of association with the University of Florida, nobody wants to live in Gainesville. That place is hideous.
I've been there.
Yeah, it's terrible. It literally is a swamp. They're not lying when they call it the swamp. It is a swamp.
No. Have you been to Chiefland?
What's that?
Have you been to Chiefland? It's right next to Gainesville?
No.
That's where my ex-wife is from. I've been there. And there were parts of it that did not have zip codes. The names of the streets were basically like the people who lived on them. It was just Bob, and then that's the street. And apparently it was like a huge deal when they got a Walmart. It was fun.
Yeah, yeah. Places like that get a gas station. It's a big thing.
We don't have to worry about insulting any of the people who live in those areas because they don't have internet. So
that is true. Besides, when it comes to Florida, Family Guy knows them best.
Everyone from Florida is stupid. Everyone from Florida is dumb. I might not be the brightest guy, but next to them my IQ's high. If they had guitars, here's how they'd strum.
By the way, everyone,
only once. What's that?
I was born in Florida. So thank you. Thank you for that. Born in Florida.
I have not set foot in Florida, and I am like dreading the day I have to. I was planning on taking that to the grave, but I don't think it's going to last. But
Florida's gross.
It is.
Anybody from there is gross.
That's my two cents.
That's it. That's all we need to know. Florida is gross. Okay,
I was in Miami I was selling t-shirts on the beach one spring break in Miami, and I could not wait to get the heck out of there.
You ever notice that all of her stories are it always like, so anyway, there I was working for the biggest drug dealer in the state of Florida, and I was selling t-shirts illegally, and when the police showed up.
It does get a little wacky. But
hey, she knows how to hustle.
I do recommend everyone try and do the beach sales so that they know what the grind is like.
No.
No. I buy something from all of them now.
No.
It doesn't matter. I'm like, yeah, I'll take a bucket and a shovel. I don't have kids. Sure, give me that umbrella and the, what are those things called?
Nobody knows but you.
Yeah.
Because none of us buy those things.
Yeah. All right. So in the news this week, in the news this week, let's you know, we've talked about these, you know, it's funny, the Democrats have their own version of like the Tea Party movement now within the House of Representatives specifically. You know, these far left kind of like social, you know, and liberal progressives, far left progressives, if you want to call them that. People like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Ilhan Omar, Rashida Tlaib, they, you know, they advocate for all kinds of goofy things like the Green New Deal, which, you know, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez said the world was going to end in 12 years. And then, you know, she said she was joking, you know, sarcasm. You know, you can't.
Listen, I'm proud you can say her full name. Can you just say AOC, please?
I don't like saying AOC.
No, just say AOC so we don't have to hear Alexandria. Blah, 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 like,
I didn't say it like that, but AOC makes it sound like, you know, it's like you're giving her that nickname like she's Michael Jackson or something.
I know. I hear a lot of pushback about that. They're like, don't call her AOC.
Yeah.
Call yourself that damn way. It.
I'm going to call her AOC.
Fine.
Well, does everybody call her else by just her last name and she just doesn't get Cortez?
That's okay, I called her Cortez earlier today and the person didn't know who I was talking about.
Right.
It's like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Oh, okay. Yeah.
We're going to start calling her Cortez.
Either that or let's annoy everyone and all of us just start going by our first, middle, and last names at all times. Well, I was talking to Benjamin Charles Howe the other day. And by the way, I would like to thank myself for having the prudence to announce what city and state I was born in and my full name on a radio show that's going to be broadcast to tons of hackers.
Well, you know, we really should be calling
to be clear, I was also born on July 8th, 1977. And the last address, I'm sorry, go ahead.
We should also just be calling her Sandy, right? Because that's what she likes to go by, is Sandy.
Oh, Clinton. Yeah, you can call her Sandy.
No, she doesn't get nicknames.
Whoa, whoa. Who wants to be called Sandy?
That's what she goes
by. She went by Sandy in college or something like that.
She goes by Sandy?
Oh, yeah, colloquially, yeah, she's Sandy.
You know, that has always been one of the weirdest things to me. I knew this guy in high school whose name was, like, Blanchard, and he didn't like his name. So he went by Chris, and I was like, oh, what is that, your middle name? And he goes, no. I was like, well, where'd you get Chris? He goes, I just like Chris. His dad called
his real name Ben Howard.
Everybody called him Chris. It had nothing to do with his name. You're not allowed to do that.
I think Sandy is a nickname for Alexandria.
If Sandy is a nickname for Alexandria, that is the stupidest thing I've ever heard.
Well, Alexandra DeSantis, she goes by Zan. I mean, she literally just tells you, please call me Zan. So she doesn't want
it. I just don't understand why some nicknames have nothing to do with the name. People are like, his name is Jack. What's that nickname for? John. What? Those are two different names. How is that a nickname? Sandy for Alexandria?
Yeah, but I mean, I've always heard the thing Jack for John. In fact, sometimes when people are like, his name is Jack, not John, he's actually named Jack.
Right, but why?
I don't know.
Is it shorten it? They're both one
they're
syllable.
They're both, I know, they're one syllable, four letters. I don't get it either.
My name's Ben, but for short, you can call me Bob. What about
Jay? Yeah, but you and Jay literally go by a syllable of your actual names.
Yeah, but that's how a nickname works.
Well, it's a shortened version.
They call you Jennifer. They call you Jen. That's a nickname. If your name is William and they shorten it to Bill.
Okay, well, here's one. How did they get Dick from Richard?
I think probably a lot of Richards are dead. Somebody got caught saying it, and they were like, no, that's just what people call Richard. And then the next thing you know, all kinds of Richards were calling. By the way, because that's short for it, my favorite politician's name of all time, Dick Armey.
Dick Armey.
Dick Armey.
And the greatest NASCAR driver of all time, if you go by names, is Dick Trickle.
So do we have a format or like some things we're going to talk about, or are we just going
to... Well, I was starting to talk about Rashida Tlaib. I don't know if we call her Rash or what, but
call her Poppy. That's her nickname out of the street. Poppy.
So Rashida Tlaib was on a podcast called the Skullduggery Podcast or something like that. And
they can do podcasts.
Who?
I don't know. People who work for us.
I guess.
Are you asking, can politicians be interviewed?
Yeah, yes. Never. They're not allowed. You never see them on TV.
I just associate it with, I guess, being from LA, it's all just comedians in studio apartments. Someone had the greatest tweet ever once. They said they call it a studio apartment because it comes with a podcast.
By the way, thank you. You're on our podcast. So we appreciate you putting down what we did.
All right, so anyway, she was
losers at politicians are going to go on a losers podcast, are they?
Basically.
Next thing you know, it's going to be like one run by bloggers. Sorry, go ahead.
All right, so anyway, Rashida Tlaib was on this podcast, and she started talking about the Holocaust and how, you know, after the end of World War II, you know, the United Nations carved out a nation for Israel for Jews from Europe to go to, and of course, you know, the myth is that, you know, the Palestinians had this land and it was taken from them, which is again is historical revisionism. There was no such thing as Palestine until it was created. So they split this land. So anyway, she was relating this story. So she goes, "Let me tell you. I mean, for me, I think 2 weeks ago we celebrated or took a moment, I think, in our country to remember the Holocaust. And there's kind of a calming feeling I always tell folks when I think of the Holocaust and the tragedy of the Holocaust and the fact that it was my ancestors, Palestinians, who lost their land, and some lost their lives, their livelihood, their human dignity, their existence in many ways had been wiped out. And some people's passports, I mean, just all of it was in the name of trying to create a safe haven for Jews. Post the Holocaust, post the tragedy and the horrific persecution of Jews across the world at the time. And I love the fact that it was my ancestors that provided that, right? In many ways, but they did in a way that took their human dignity away and it was forced on them." Now, what kills me about this is, you know, anybody who's Jewish or knows any Jewish history, this would kind of outrage them. And it should, because it's revisionist history 101. You know, the Palestinians
that's
actually
one of the hardest courses I took in college. Revisionist history 101. That was really tough.
Well,
teacher,
I mean,
just came up with new shit every fucking week, and I never knew what he was going to revise.
Well, you could tell him to run for Congress, because, you know, the Palestinians basically collaborated with Adolf Hitler to continue to persecute the Jews here, Jews in Israel, I should say. I'm sorry, not here. Anyway, I think everybody kind of knows what she said. The point was is that
I'm sure enough, already mentioned Hitler, by the way, but go ahead.
Yeah, she was criticized for it, and rightly so. And what she did was what Ilhan Omar does, what AOC Sandy does, is retreat into this kind of victimhood status. They say something, and then they're like, "You can't silence me," or they claim, when you repeat their exact words, that you're twisting their words.
Yes. She does that with the 12-year thing all the time. She very seriously said we had 12 years left, and now she's mad at people who are taking her seriously and claiming that we purposefully are acting like she wasn't being hyperbolic. No, the point was we were saying you were being hyperbolic. Thank you for agreeing with us. The world's not ending in 12 years.
Right. Well, she's doing the whole take me literally. Don't take me literally, but take me seriously.
The Palestinian thing that interests me is that, you know, When everything started in the early 20th century, you're talking about Jews that were escaping Germany, and there were already Jews living in Israel. People were emigrating from all over the world, Jews from everywhere coming there. So you're talking about a population that was naturally having shifting demographics at one point. And this is what they complain that the alt-right says about, like, Mexico. They're saying that Mexicans are going to come here and the demographics are going to shift, and then they're called racist for that. They're embracing an alt-right talking point by pretending that Jews coming and moving to Israel in large numbers was taking land away from Palestinians. That's the same kind of ethnic segregation that the alt-right is citing at the Mexican border. They're embracing an alt-right talking point about Israel.
Yeah, that's a good point. You know, it's funny, if we had time, I'd find it. Maybe I could still dig it up. There was one of the best ways of best descriptions I heard of Israel and, you know, what it's like and all this other kind of thing in terms of, you know, what they have, you know, for them to sit there and say that they're the aggressors all the time is Howard Stern going off on Roger Waters, talking about, you know, Roger Waters is one of those guys. He wrote like letters to like other bands who are playing in Israel and told them not to play there because he's such a Jew hater, you know, and constantly like talking up the Palestinians. And, you know, the worst part is that now, granted, I will admit that Liz Cheney's tweet about it, where she said, Rashida Tlaib said the Holocaust gives her a calming feeling. That's not really what she said. And it's like, you didn't have to kind of embellish to understand just how bad it was.
Yeah.
So that hurt a little bit.
I'm more disturbed that I'm getting this information about Pink Floyd, but go ahead.
Oh, you didn't know about Roger Waters?
I try not to know these things. I avoid them at all costs, and people like you keep bringing it to me. I don't want to know.
Well, it's not Pink Floyd. It's just Roger Waters.
Didn't Howard Stern have a huge... Didn't Howard Stern go off on Roger Waters when he did that to
fans? Yeah, I just mentioned that, and so yeah. You obviously
good thing Andrew
attention.
Was listening to the show.
The news gal is on top of it.
Andrew and I are texting each other.
No, but I did kind of want to ask Bridget, though. I mean, so something...
Don't ask
happened
me anything about it.
No. But you know, Cortez, as we've decided we're going to call her, me and you, Bridget. Yes. Cortez did go to the salon, and she got told her eyebrows were too big for her face, and that is just like, and I know you saw this because you were saying like what happens when you go into a salon and you have women critiquing you and upselling you, you're gonna hear that kind of stuff.
Yeah, what was there some kind of drama around this where conservatives like getting on her and saying that she made this up? I feel like I saw someone tweeting about this and they were saying, now she's saying this. And every conservative woman was like, yeah, that's pretty true. When you go into a salon, they talk shit about you. That's just 100% fact.
Do you think her eyebrows are too big for her face?
Oh, I don't know.
I do.
No, I looked at her too and I was just like, I have no opinion on this.
I would have to look at her face.
I do enjoy that we just switched from the Israeli-Palestinian conflict to
So the good part is while they were talking about that, I happened to find the thing with Howard Stern. So let me play a little bit of this.
Jim.
And if you take a look over there, Roger, genius, Mr. Pink Floyd. Israel is like, if you, there are so many Arab countries and so much land around Israel. If you threw a pin in a pool, that's what Israel is. Picture a desert with no natural resources, no water, no oil. It was a shithole that nomads essentially would walk over. So they figured, where's the one place they can stick Jews where no one will be offended? They stick because the Jews are getting killed all over the world. So they give them a little homeland on a desert where there's no water, where essentially no one could live. And no one did live there, despite the bullshit. And the Palestinians are these Arabs that could live in Egypt, they could live in Saudi Arabia, but guess what? Those countries don't want them either. So they have a country, and Israel has a little tiny country. And it bugs the shit out of Roger Waters. He can't fucking deal with it. He's writing letters to Bon Jovi. Don't go there. It's a terrible place. Where do you want the Jews to go, Roger? Where do you want them to go? You want them to just go back to the concentration camp? What is it you want, fuckhead?
So sorry to disappoint you, Ben, that Roger Waters is an anti-Semite.
Yeah, well, I'm more impressed that that Howard Stern is pro-Israel.
Oh, yeah.
I like the fact that he was like, Mr. Pink Floyd.
Mr. Pink Floyd. In fact, later on in the thing, he sits there and he says, you'd be more worried about getting back together with Pink Floyd than Israel, patching things up with the rest of the members of Pink Floyd.
Thing is, you know, with this whole topic, one of the things that bugs me is that people just aren't being honest. What he pointed out is something that's very true, which is Republicans, who I'm not exactly like a fan of these days, But the claim always was that our interests in the Middle East, that Republican interests in the Middle East centered around the desire for oil, 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 oil. Then why is the country that we keep supporting over every other country the one country that doesn't have oil?
Right. Well, they've shifted the narrative, so they know that they can't use the oil excuse. So they sit there and talk about the biggest supporters of Israel in the United States are evangelical Christians, and that's only because of the whole biblical thing. You know, it has nothing to do with the fact that they are the only true democracy in the Middle East. It has nothing to do with that. You know,
I think that definitely there's a lot of evangelicals who, it's not that they support Israel in terms of their policies and where they stand with other countries,
right,
because of their relationship with the Bible,
right,
or specifically their relationship with Revelation. But I do think there's a lot of evangelicals that are more than likely, let's say some insane person got into office in Israel and he really was a terrible person. I think a lot of evangelicals probably still support Israel.
Yeah, probably. I mean, there's some, but what I'm saying is that's not the overarching reason why Republicans and conservatives support Israel.
There's no reason to think it is, because for now, there isn't an insane person that's running the country, and they are our greatest ally in the Middle East. And we should have a good relationship. It is a tiny, 3 miles wide or something? I mean, it's so small. They're surrounded by countries that are hostile to their existence, and everybody acts like they're the bully.
Right. You know, it's like, that's when you always see, Palestinian killed after, when Israel, fires over them or the war. But that's like, then you read the story and it's like, oh, yeah, well, that's because, the Palestinians fired 200 rockets into Israel.
Right. I watched a video just the other day. It was like a Voxplain video, because I was wanting to see what they said about the history of the Palestinian and Israeli conflict or Jewish conflict. And they just glossed over like 10 years of their history by saying, some shit happened and, both sides, committed violence. But when you actually look at what happened at the time, sure, both sides committed violence. If you're attacked by someone and you attack them back to protect yourself, then technically you both committed violence. That's true. But when you don't provide that context and just say both sides did something, then it certainly sounds like you're saying they're equally guilty, and they're not.
Right. And credit, I'm going to give credit in this one, because we sometimes, we harangue the media and everything. But John King at CNN did a segment where he basically said, he expressed that it was revisionist history rather than the story being about the reaction. We always joke about, pouncing and seizing and everything like that. But I mean, in a more serious note, the story always seems to be a lot of times about how Republicans have reacted to something that Rashida Tlaib or AOC or somebody else said, rather than what they're saying. And John King on CNN basically said, this is revisionist history, and talked about what I just said at the top, saying that the Palestinians aligned with they teamed up with Hitler. They declared war, all out kind of war at the notion that Israel was going to be an independent state. So, that brings up the broader point. And we mentioned it with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, with her 12-year thing, and Ilhan Omar does the same thing. She'll say something, that is obviously like an anti-Semitic trope, and then all they do is whine about being attacked. And I was listening to the commentary podcast the other day, and Christine Rosen was like, "Don't they realize that they are elected officials? They are public figures, and that what they say matters. They're no longer activists."
Right. No, they don't. That's a really simple answer. No, they don't.
Moving along. So
they're much more like, I it's fine for, AOC tweets about the eyebrows. I don't care about that. But it is like endemic of politicians these days. They're much more concerned about their periscope of them getting their hair cut than whether being held accountable for things they say publicly.
Yeah, and I mean, AOC with the 12-year thing, I mean, I watched, so everybody else didn't have to, that town hall that she did with Chris Hayes. I mean, she said, "We have an expiration date." Those were the words that she used. "We have an expiration date." And then she was just like, "We have to do something, or we're doomed. We're doomed." She said, "If we keep debating it, we're like frogs in the boiling water." I mean, everything that she said during that town hall was...
So she's like the Jon Snow, like, you know, calling out about the Night King is what she sounds like.
Yes, pretty much.
By the way, we need to talk about Game of Thrones. I just want to put that out there, but go ahead.
That is
our last chance to talk about Game of Thrones.
Wait, does Bridget, do you watch Game of Thrones?
Yes.
Okay, so you know what? We'll do some premium content Game of Thrones talk.
Nice.
All right. So for everyone,
what you said about take me literally, not seriously.
Right.
Isn't that like the whole Trump method?
Right. Well, no. She wants to be taken. Don't take me literally, but take me seriously. And that's
what they all accuse Trump of doing.
Yes.
Right. Doing the same thing.
Right.
Yeah. Exactly. I mean, her Twitter feed is basically a Democratic version of Trump. She says a bunch of stupid shit, gets called out on it, and then complains about, you know, being called out as opposed to, you know, taking ownership of what she said.
You know, what's interesting is it's one of the pushbacks that I had of many against Trump was what he was going to do in terms of the norms, like Tom always talks about. And one of the dangerous things to me is, yes, she's using a lot of the communication methods that Trump uses, which in a lot of ways is really just Twitter communication. It's not like Trump invented them. She's doing a lot of the things that people do on Twitter. She's acting like somebody who was active on Twitter. But the difference between her and Trump, and why I won't call her the left's version of Trump, is because every single ideological position Trump stakes out is not actually his ideological position. She has ideological positions. Like, yes. She believes stuff.
Right.
And so to me, the idea of Trump is disturbing enough given who he is. The idea of Trump, the ideologue, that's a lot scarier to me. And so AOC to me, it's like a little different because yeah, she does all that same crap, but she also actually thinks this shit.
That is true. But other politicians are like, Dan Crenshaw is using Twitter in a way that, I mean, for a while there, he started getting
an eye patch.
What's that?
Dan Crenshaw makes me wish I had an eye patch. I mean, it's like you put an eye patch on, I don't care what you look like. If you're a man, you just became like a serious man.
And by the way, for those of you who haven't picked up the issue yet, especially if you're in D.C., you could just go ahead and grab one. Dan Crenshaw is on the cover of this week's Washington Examiner magazine. Big feature on him. He did a Twitter, I don't know if it was a Periscope or it was just regular Twitter video, but he did this video where he explained about a bill that they had just voted on, and he said the Democrats kind of like made it out to be something about pre-existing conditions, and I can't even remember exactly what he was talking about because it was a very wonky kind of video, but it was a great explainer where he was saying it had nothing to do with pre-existing conditions. It was about, you know, states having some more flexibility, which is allowed under Obamacare, and them doing that. And Democrats are just trying to set it up as if we're voting against protecting pre-existing conditions, but it has nothing to do with that. And, I don't see many politicians using their Twitter feeds for that. I know, like, what's his name from Michigan? Justin Amash would, his Facebook page, he would, every bill that they voted on, he would explain why he voted for it or against it. Now, for some people, I think it's probably boring. You know, they probably want it. I'd rather watch Kamala Harris cooking, you know, with her pearls on and her tons of jewelry and her watch and everything else and an apron that looks like it just came out of the package.
Yeah, I was just saying today that Donald Trump has brought he brought reality television to DC, and now all of the worst parts of reality television are starting to trickle their way into the rest of DC. Like, it's like reality TV started out with Cops, you know, which was kind of gritty and everything. And eventually we were watching people have confessionals about whether or not they liked the other person in the house full of washed up celebrities. And now we've got politicians doing haircuts on Periscope.
Right.
It's just going to get worse from here.
Right. I always remember, you know, it was right after the election when Bill Burr was on Conan, and he said a reality TV, is going to run the country. He's like, the guy who decided whether Bret Michaels or Cyndi Lauper would be the better CEO of a company that doesn't exist is going to run things. And so and so now we have that. And, you know, Beto O'Rourke, who did the stupid thing with his dentist, he goes, like you said, I'm assuming you were referring to him, live streaming and getting his hair cut.
Yeah, he was getting his hair cut.
I don't want to see that.
No.
But apparently he was interviewing the guy about his work and his immigration or something like that.
Oh.
I think he's just getting a haircut as part of his journey of self-discovery.
How old is he? And, you know, it's funny, he tries to do the self-discovery thing, and it's like, dude, you're like 46 years old. You know, you're not 30 or 25
he,
or anything.
He has young children. He said less than a year ago that running for president would, quote, destroy his family. That, and then he lost the Senate race to Ted Cruz and immediately left a month and a half later on a road trip around the country. I don't think this guy needs to go home and work out issues with his wife and kids. Like, that, like there's something.
I think it's going
to speculate and be like nasty or anything like that, but something is off there.
And I thought the irony of all ironies this week was Vanity Fair reporting that Beto O'Rourke regretted launching his campaign with a story in Vanity Fair. It was like, I mean, come on. The guy was featured in Town and Country last year, for crying out loud. Town and Country. He was the flavor of the month. And, you know, so it was like everybody loved him and everybody thought, of course, it's like you lost your Senate race and all these people sitting there thinking he could still win the presidency.
Yes, because it's not based on anything any longer. What they cared about was how well he did in Texas.
Right. They don't care about that.
Yeah,
right.
And people still say they're like, oh, I wish he would just run against Cornyn. People like him less than Ted Cruz. I'm like, no, they do not. I mean, I was there. Ted Cruz is very popular in certain areas of Texas.
But he's polarizing.
And very conservative, but he's very polarizing. You know, Cornyn would have wiped the floor with Beto O'Rourke because he would have basically taken in all the Republican voters, everybody who might have stayed home. And, you know, I think a lot of Democrats were excited at the possibility of Ted Cruz losing. I don't think that they'll get that excited about running out and saying, well, we really got to get rid of John Cornyn. John Cornyn is your basic establishment Republican.
Mm-hmm.
Ones that Ben hates.
I actually made several campaign videos for John Cornyn a few years ago and for Ted Cruz. So,
well, of course, you're a whore. So, you mean, you'll sit there and anybody's going to pay you. You're going to take the money. No, that's
terrible. I want to make sure they ever heard you on that, by the way.
No, and I can't say that about Ben. I actually worked for him for a while, so.
I paid like shit.
Hey, man. We could get weepy here when I could sit there and tell you how, you know, how much that meant to me.
He does, Ben. He will get weepy about the time that he worked for you.
Yeah.
Because it meant a lot.
It was a big fucking deal. It was. It got me through three tough months.
No, I remember at the time, you know, I basically paid you out of pity.
Yeah. I pity you. I'm doing this for your wife and kids, Jack. Not for you. It's like, yeah. And then, of course, when I got the job at Home Depot, he's like, you motherfucker. Like, what the
fuck? Yeah, right.
We're just, it's going to get busy now. So whatever. Anyway.
Then it started getting busy on the back of your sweat, and I didn't know how to do the work I assigned you to do.
So, you know, I forgot what we were talking about now. We're talking about John Cornyn and joking
this week
around.
Than usual, it feels like.
Yeah.
We're usually like clipping along on one subject and then another. I feel like we're just having a fun phone call this time.
Yeah. No, I'm good with this. And no, I'm kind of excited. My daughter's coming down next
week. Talking about, you know, like overweight men and stuff like that. It reminded me of a reply to Tom Nichols, who was on the podcast, you know, a month or so ago, posted a photo of himself today.
Reading his own USA Today article.
And I'm sorry, but the reply of the GIF of the cartoon guy, like smacking his boob.
Yeah. So I don't know. Did you guys see the tweet?
Oh, I saw it.
I saw it. Bridget, did you see it?
Tom Nichols?
Yeah.
Everyone saw it.
Okay, now one of the funniest replies in there was like, first Bridget Fetasy, now Tom Nichols.
Look, everyone wants to see my nipple.
Yeah, nobody ever asked to see Tom Nichols' nipple.
Oh.
And by the way, Tom Nichol nipple is like a funny sentence.
Yes.
In addition to that, he's the guy who gets upset about people having bare feet.
Oh, bare feet on airplanes, yeah.
And he's tweeting pictures of his nipple
Literally every comment was someone saying something about that.
About that faux pas.
Somebody.
It's so hilarious that who knew that a male nipple was like more controversial than a female's nipple, but yet it absolutely was. It was like an appalling thing.
That's because he deleted the tweet. My assumption, had I been asked, was that I would go for the rest of my life without knowing what size nipples Tom Nichols has. And now I know the size, dimensions, and colors associated with Tom Nichols' nipple.
I was reading through the replies this morning, and I could not stop laughing. Some of them were just so damn funny. Okay. Somebody was like, fixed it for you and put a black bar over the nipple.
No, there's only so much room in the brain for your memory. I have four children. One of my precious memories about my children has now been pushed out of my head to make room for Tom Nichols' nipple. By the way, Tom, if you're listening, you've got silver dollars.
Did he take it down?
Yeah, he did. He deleted it.
Doesn't matter.
No, it's out there, and you know people screenshot
it.
In
my brain anyway.
And he's never going to get over that.
My own nipples.
Something topped the Led Zeppelin hatred that he had to suffer under. So now it's just all going to be nipple jokes until the end of time.
I really hope the next time he's on Morning Joe brings fun
of the Led Zeppelin. Like, I would have been fine with him not liking Led Zeppelin forever. To not know the exact freaking color code of Tom Nichols' nipple. Like, if you gave me a color wheel, I could now pick out where on the color wheel Tom Nichols' nipple is. And that is not something I needed in my life.
If he was a good sport about it, he would change his, like, display name to Tom Nipple.
Yeah. I'm thinking about, like, honestly, I'm thinking about DMing him a dick pic. Just like, here, you know what? You gave me this. Congratulations. Now have this in your head, jerk.
So much stigma around the male nipple. Free the nipple, guys.
Well, I mean, I think that there's certain guys that can get away with it, right?
Like Chris Hemsworth.
Well,
not Fat Thor Chris Hemsworth.
Yeah, not Dad Bod Chris Hemsworth.
No.
You know, Chris Hemsworth could post a picture and with his nipples out.
Please do, Chris Hemsworth.
But if you've got anything that could be described as a moob.
No. Yeah, you're not going to see my nipple on Twitter anytime soon.
Jay, I
or will we?
Time that you wouldn't.
That's kind of up to me, not you.
And now you've mentioned your own nipple, and now it's in my head. Thanks a lot.
I'm topless right now.
Same.
There we go. Everyone's brain was just cleansed.
Instant cleanse.
Everyone's listening. Everyone listening to the podcast, like, thank you, Bridget. Thank you.
Yeah. We've already gone through Jay's nipple, Tom's nipple, and Ben's dick pic.
Yeah. So that was a news story. I was supposed to be a news story, Andrea. So
So
we'll get to another news story. But there was something that was in the New York Times that was written, and somebody else wrote something for the Spectator about, you know, it was a millennial writing about how terrible Generation X is.
I think it was Caroline McCarthy.
And you know, okay, so I read the article and I was like. In her tweet, she mentioned the name, and I didn't know what it was.
What?
It was here. Hold on a second. I gotta.
Put it under her post that I was.
Well, she said something about Jordan Catalano, and I'm like, who
Jordan
the fuck
Catalano.
Is that?
He's from my so-called life.
Yes. Yeah, now I was just like, please, no Gen Xers I know give a rat's ass about my so-called life. I didn't even know who Jordan Catalano was before looking it up.
Oh, I did.
Her critique of Generation X stuff was kind of like the kind of stuff that everybody associates people with. Like everybody who's Generation X just absolutely adores and loves Kurt Cobain. Well, not really. You know, I mean, I like Kurt Cobain. I like Nirvana. I think Foo Fighters are a better band. You know,
come on, Jay. We're done.
Come on now. It's true.
Wait, you say Foo Fighters are a better band than who?
Nirvana.
Nirvana.
No.
Yeah. Wasting Light is better than anything. And now, granted, now remember, Nirvana was only around for like 3 years. We don't know what they could have done.
Wait a second. Aren't you like 55 or something?
No, I'm not 55, fool.
What? Were you a teenager during the grunge era, or were you already like...
Oh. He was in his
20s. I was in my early 20s.
Forget it.
But Foo Fighters came out in 1994. What's the matter with you people?
Yeah, so in other words, you're not assigning certain type of status to Nirvana because you didn't live through it, bro.
I did live through it, you doofus.
You lived through it in your 20s. That would be like me talking about Blink 182.
Oh, God.
It's not the same.
Blink 182. Is that a millennial thing or is that Gen X?
No, that's millennial.
Oh, good.
No. It's both.
Blink 182 was big in my junior sophomore.
Well, they did that video where they were making fun of.
When you're an adult, you talk about music, you're looking at it objectively because it's not tied to your over dramatic teen years. But for people who are actually, you know, teenagers during the Nirvana era, it's very different, and that's why Jay doesn't understand.
No,
and
it's
why Andrew doesn't understand because she's got the word of millennial.
I don't understand why there were four or five hit pieces on Gen Xers this week.
Yeah, it was like
crazy.
It was bad.
And it was another thing where I think it was Noah Rothman or somebody, I think from commentary, said okay, this person just was just talking about, you know, that this year's Gen X, you know, Democratic nominees were like crappy nominees for president, and they were the first to ever run for president. And they were like, well, I guess Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz are, you know, just forgotten to history now, you know, because they were the first two to actually run seriously for president.
Mm. Well, so here's the thing about this. This is something that was written actually in... This was something that was written in a 1990 Time cover story about Generation X. They have few heroes, no anthems, no style to call their own. They crave entertainment, but their attention span is as short as one zap of a TV dial. TV dial. So it's 1990. They hate yuppies, hippies, and druggies. They postpone marriage because they dread divorce. They sneer at Range Rovers, Rolexes, and red suspenders.
Wait, is she talking about Gen X or millennials?
Well, This was Gen X because it said a 1990 cover story called 20 something.
Hmm.
But I don't.
Yeah, and millennials don't put off marriage because they fear divorce. They
no. This is she was saying this
divorce.
Well, they were saying this. They were saying this about Gen X, not about millennials.
And this was
I know, but Ben's asking, that can't be about millennials because millennials don't fear divorce. They aren't not getting married because they fear divorce like Gen Xers did. They don't get married because they literally are paying off and going to college most of their 20s. So that's why they're putting off, you know, and then they're paying off debts and not wanting to get into relationships and have children before they're, you know, financially stable and stuff like that. And the starter home is a complete, you know, an utter disaster now. I mean, millennials don't do, you know, the small $200,000 house and fix it up and then move on to a bigger, nicer house later on.
I enjoy the logic, by the way, of like having trouble keeping up and thinking that the worst thing you could do is have two household incomes. Why would you not want to get married in a situation where you're having difficulty making ends meet? That seems like a really illogical reason to not get married.
Bridget, you read this article, right? I'm reading it. I'm like, who wrote this?
Yeah, that doesn't sound like Gen X to me.
No.
Not even the 90s time. I'm just talking about the New York Times story altogether. We invented woke. What do you mean we invented woke?
Invent woke. How? I don't understand that logic.
No, yeah. Millennials absolutely invented woke.
Yeah.
What?
Yeah.
Millennials.
Yeah.
Gen X.
No. Gen X, first of all, what were they talking about hating Range Rovers and stuff? I knew like five hippies who had Range Rovers when I was a teenager in the 90s. Like, what Gen Xers are they talking about?
I don't know. I'm trying to find out who wrote the New York Times article. Is a guy named Al, or, well, I don't know if it's a guy. Could be a...
This is, look, just, y'all correct me if you think I'm wrong. When I think of Gen Xers, I think of people who love 80s movies, who know a lot of glam rock, who listened to things like Milli Vanilli when they were in middle school, and who were in the grunge rock era and spent the 90s watching the Clinton saga unfold. Like, that to me is a Gen Xer.
Yeah, I think of Jay when I think of Gen X, which is basically that.
Yeah. So I don't know where all these additional attributes are coming from. It's like they're trying to break Gen Xers down into somebody they knew and not something that has a broad spectrum of what people dealt with and were like. But generations are kind of bullshit anyway. The whole idea of generations is kind of
bullshit. That's true. Yeah.
Especially now with the technology, because I was reading a whole piece about how it's shortening the generational time. And even watching when I was interviewing my nephews between the ages of 10 and 18, the difference between the 18-year-old and the 10-year-old is basically a generation, and it's like 8 years. Just because of where they fell in growing up with technology.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they say that, you know, it's like the first time I heard this was several years ago, but the generation after millennial, which is, you know, like my daughter, they call it, they've kind of like coined it so far because they're still little kids, but the I generation, which basically my daughter was born a year after the touchscreen on the iPad and the iPhone came out. My daughter never knew a time where you could not touch a screen and have it move.
How old is she?
She'll be 11 in July.
Yeah, that's like my nephew. I did a whole interview with them about when they got their phones, and as basically the middle child, they made the oldest wait. You know, they kind of held out, and then he finally got one later in his probably high school, or maybe earlier than that, maybe junior high, and then they slowly kind of upped the time, and then the 14-year-old got his, I think he was in like third grade, and then the kid, the youngest got his when his older brother got it. And my sister was like, yeah, the wheels kind of fell off the train on that one. So he has had a cell phone since he was in kindergarten.
Yeah. So this other article in the Times, this is the one I think that you were talking about, Andrea, is this Gen X mess.
Yeah.
The tech, music, style, books, trends, rules, films, and pills that made Gen X so. And so it goes down and it starts like harping on things like CDs and like, oh, you didn't have like the good music, and you didn't have like, you had to sit there, you had to stay on the phone for an hour. You know, like you had to talk on an actual phone, and, you know, you didn't have great cell phones. You had beepers and stuff like that. I don't understand. What does that have to do with anything?
I didn't really understand this piece, and maybe. Yeah,
there's a couple of them. I don't get it. Maybe because they're like, oh, well, that's because you're just biased because you're Gen X. You can't see it.
But what's the point of the piece? What is the thesis?
That's the whole thing. They're saying everything is so because it's not
Gen
as
X
advanced.
Is a mess. Yeah.
As advanced as it is now?
Yeah, we are a fucking mess.
How old is, what generation is the writer from? That's what I want to know.
She's a millennial, right?
Well, that was the one from The Spectator. I still don't know who this Alex Williams is. That I can't seem to like get any information. It's like there's an Alex Williams New York City on Twitter, and it is okay. Yeah, it's a guy. I can't tell how old he is though. New York Times reporter and feature writer, Styles Desk.
As long as he's over 40, he's in that Gen X generation. But you know, it's like the Gen X age started around, you know, it's like Bridget said, you know, it's a very specious kind of like time frame, but it started around 1964, and so it's like, that's why I always think if the person's not at least, you know, like Jay, you're not quite 50, like if they're not your age, you know, like right around that 50 age year mark, I would find that a little bit hard to take them seriously on their kind of ideas and thoughts on Gen X, just because it's also been so far since they were really like young and kind of finding out who they were, that now they're kind of this older age group that the boomers were in the 90s with Clinton. that you're kind of talking about a completely different, I mean, you're having to figure out what people are now, and you're trying to apply things that are 20 years old to how people are today. And I'm with Bridget. It's a really like putting people into kind of cookie cutter generations is
okay. So all right. So I found it. So this guy Alex Williams is 53 years old. No, 54.
I knew it. He's basically a boomer.
Yeah. God no. damn it. That's what I'm looking at his. Yes, he is at 54.
He's smack dab in the, no. in the Gen X.
No.
Yes.
He's like he's on yes. the. No. He's like on the border.
Yes. He's like an old. How we're. I guess technically I'm a Zennial. I'm in that weird Oregon Trail generation that's in between. And I feel like this guy is in between boomers and Gen X because he writes like a fucking boomer.
Mm-hmm. I mean, Barack Obama was born 61, 3 years before this guy, Alex Williams. So it's
Barack Obama's a boomer.
Yeah, yeah. Well, this guy's like right on that edge. And he Bridget nailed it. He writes like a boomer.
Mm-hmm.
So he's just jealous. So remember that? Jealous.
Like, we're literally right now complaining about the older generation not understanding.
You guys just sound like Gen Xers.
Do y'all understand that? That we're literally on a radio show going, you know what? The older generation, they just don't get us, man. We just read what they wrote, and he's a freaking boomer.
Yeah, I don't understand the point. I feel like they just forgot about Gen X. Like, everyone's been getting blamed. The boomers and the millennials. And then I think somebody tonight did a whole tweet about this where Gen Xers are like the middle child that just tries to stay out.
Oh, that was Beckett. Yeah.
Yeah, Beckett. And I think that's accurate. And then everybody was like, hey, Gen Xers haven't taken any shit for all the problems in the world. And it's really their fault. So now they're just looking. It's just people looking for someone new to blame.
Yeah, well, it is the mess we are in. The boomers are to blame for most of our problems. I mean, and there's no doubt about that.
The silent generation and actually the greatest generation are the ones who brought us, you know, all the great society stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, but of course the boomers just made it worse.
But I'm not going to be a scapegoat for the boomers.
No.
So Stephen Green posted on Facebook from Twitter, and it was a meme of the Brady girls, and it's Jan or it's Marcia as the boomer saying, I'm so popular. This. It's Jan saying, I hate this fucking family as a Gen Xer. And then the youngest, I can't remember her name.
Cindy.
Cindy as a millennial saying, I'm so cute.
I get the feeling that every asshole moderate and centrist is probably like a Gen Xer. Yeah. I'm starting to realize where my people are, and they're all Gen Xers. Because no millennials are on the fence.
You know why? It's because Gen Xers, and I have nothing to back this up, it's because Gen Xers are most likely to have watched South Park throughout their 20s and into their 30s and don't want to be the shitheads that the South Park people always make fun of.
Making fun of, yeah.
Such a small population of people.
Nah, they saved Comedy Central like completely on their own. Everybody I knew watched South Park.
I still think that if somebody said this, if you went out and asked how many people who Cartman was, it would be a very small portion of the population who actually knew.
Mm-hmm.
I totally disagree.
No, I don't. I'm with
you. That's not how cultural influence works anyway. It trickles out through the population. Their influence, Game of Thrones, look, how many people watched that? 18 million, 20 million? You know,
that's
near the adult population that watches television, and yet it has huge cultural influence, and you've got people saying winter is coming even if they don't watch the show.
Yeah, that is true.
But the other part of that though is that a small portion of the population can watch a show, and if they're in the right places of influence, they can totally affect how something's taken. The whole White House was playing Edelweiss, and they should know that is, you know,
Nazi song.
What show is that on Amazon?
Oh,
Man in the High Tower. Yeah. It's the theme song to Man in the High Tower, but that's not how what that song is known for. It's known as being the anti-Nazi song, the kind of like, oh hey, we're not Nazis, we're not German, we're Austrian, and we're gonna sing Edelweiss to stick it in the eye of the Nazis. And yet a handful, including Maggie Haberman of the New York Times, took it, the White House playing it on the loudspeakers in the Rose Garden before a press conference as some kind of weird omen after the Mueller report was released and Barr released his report, that it was some kind of like, you know, dystopian homage to, you know, weird, you know, politics. It's just amazing that, and how many people know that that is the theme song for Man in the High Tower, which is a dystopian, futuristic Amazon
show.
It's
not a dystopian. It's kind of like it imagines what would have happened if Japan and Germany had won World War II. And so the United States is split in half. You know, the Midwest to the West Coast is run by Japan, and the Midwest to the East Coast is run by the Germans. And so it does that, and so that's the reason why it uses that song. But I mean, yeah, I mean, that's the kind of silliness that goes around. So, but let's, you know, talking about the cultural significance, and we're talking about Game of Thrones, might as well just stay on that subject.
I'm going to tune out.
Unfortunately, Andrea does. Oh, wait, don't you have any other news stories other than Tom Nichols' nipple?
No, I did, but I don't have them up on my computer because you were on my computer so long that I didn't have them. Oh. I had them, but now they're.
So before you, if you're gonna tune out, you just you got to say Tom Nichols' nipple real fast.
Tom Nichols' nipple.
Ben.
Oh, I said, can y'all just fight right in front of us about who's been on Dave's computer too much?
No, we just want to hear you say Tom Nichols' nipple.
Tom Nichols' nipple.
Tom Nichols' nipple.
Tom Nichols' nipple.
All right, so there weren't any nipples. At least I don't think there were in the most recent episode of Game of Thrones, which has set the stage for what is going to be the final episode of the series. You know,
is this premium content?
Nah, we're just going to keep it here. So
okay, but I have one last thing to say before you move on to thingy. I wanted to just say really quickly that it is amazing if we're talking about generational things and you're talking about South Park, that millennials grew up on Family Guy, and the idea that millennials and the quote woke generation can even grow up on a show like Family Guy and be as snowflakey, you know, to use a Tommy Lauren term, as they are about, you know, just me making fun of, I mean, from anything from gays to handicapped people to, you know, Bill Clinton and Rush Limbaugh. I mean, they really covered the gamut. And you know, now they're kind of like kowtowing to the, you know, left and saying, oh, we're not going to make any more gay jokes anymore, which is whatever. It is what it is. But yeah, that they can grow up watching that show. And I'm still kind of like waiting for, you know, it's like the millennials have, you know, decided that Apu is offensive on The Simpsons and things like that. So anyways, that's all I wanted to just add before you moved into.
Get out of the left lane, you stupid Asian bitch. I don't even know why you are there.
So there you go. There's...
What was that?
That was Family Guy.
That was Family Guy.
Okay.
Huh?
I didn't know that was from Family Guy.
Oh yeah. That's where the Florida one was from, is when they became the folk singing duo that went out and hit the road, and that was a good one. Hey, did you guys see the Family Guy thing where they were making fun of
Hannity?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was hilarious.
That was hilarious.
So funny. The last line was the best line.
Which was the last one again?
The one where he said, drowned man pulled out of a lake, Colin Farrell.
Oh, yeah. all right. So Game of Thrones. You know, it's funny. I've seen people who say they love this show so much and couldn't wait for this final season do nothing but a bunch of bitching after each episode. You know, it's like, huh?
You're talking to one of them.
Oh, you're one of them complaining?
Look, it's not that I think that the way that the character arcs ended are bad. It's that if the character arcs were going to end in this way, with this particular ending. They should have brought us to that point instead of just trying to shoehorn it in season 8.
Ben started the petition online to rewrite season 8.
No.
So, I mean, you know, it's funny, just so we know now, which we did have in premium content when we talked to David French about Game of Thrones, that my prediction about Jaime Lannister was like way off. You know, I said he was going to die a hero, and that son of a bitch goes running back to his stupid sister lover to die.
That's part of the, like, look.
Oh, and if you haven't watched it, there's going to be spoilers here. So if you haven't caught up by now, too bad.
No spoilers, man. Nobody who cares about spoilers hasn't watched it yet.
Well, you know, it's funny. In my newsletter, I talked about the 25th anniversary of Pulp Fiction, and Andrea edits that, and she put in a spoiler alert about Pulp Fiction.
Spoiler alert, John Travolta's character dies.
All right, no, so go ahead. I'm sorry.
I was just reading it. I was reading it, and I was just horrified. I was like, he just gave an entire synopsis of the entire movie. For anyone who hasn't seen it, if they read this, that, like, there needs to be a spoiler warning. Yeah, I don't care how old it is.
A person who couldn't go see that movie when they were 16 is now 41. If they haven't seen it, they're not going to see it.
Okay. But this is the thing.
Go ahead.
So Jamie, as the example here, because you brought him up. I could accept a story arc. Absolutely, I could accept a story arc where you're watching somebody go on a huge redemption story and then ultimately have it end tragically as they re-embrace all the things that they had tried to get away from. That's an interesting story arc, even though it ends badly,
right,
as his did. But they didn't do that. They spent 7 seasons taking us from episode 1. He pushes a boy out of a window to his death, he thought, to protect his incestuous relationship with his sister.
Right.
And by season 8, he's knighting the first female knight in all of Westeros, and everybody's doing a slow clap for her.
Right.
And then over the period of basically the length of one episode, he just goes, nah, goes back and dies with her, and they try to make us have some kind of empathy for her, that she wanted her child to live. It just felt like it almost felt like Martin said, here's where everybody's story arcs end. Get them there. And their best idea was to just go, okay, next episode, they become that. Like, they didn't take us there at all. And this is one of the reasons it's most frustrating to me, is not because if the whole show, if all 8 seasons had followed that pace, I might really like what's happening right now, but that's not the pace they followed. There were so many story arcs throughout the history of the show. They had Tyrion traveling from Westeros to Meereen for an entire season. It took a whole season just for him to get from one city to another city.
Right.
And now they're doing entire shifts of 7 seasons worth of character building. They're shifting it over the course of one episode. It's just too fast. They needed to either give themselves more seasons, give themselves more episodes, or make the episodes longer, or cut down the amount of arcs that they had to address. Because the only characters that are really getting their arcs fulfilled in the way that they seem like they were meant to are more of the important secondary characters. Brienne's arc feels pretty complete.
Right.
The Hound's arc feels pretty complete, and none of what happened with them is like, that's surprising. It all makes sense. It works. With Jaime and Tyrion, like, you know, not only does Jaime suddenly just reject 7 seasons of redemption, you've got Tyrion, who was the most clever man in the whole kingdom, just stupid out of nowhere.
Yes,
you've got
Jon, exactly,
who used to face down entire armies and literally came back to life after being stabbed to death, so weak for the fact that he's got a crush on a girl that he's completely forgotten how to do military tactics whatsoever. Grey Worm, the most honorable and disciplined man ever, stabbing and murdering people who've already surrendered. Like, everybody's arcs just suddenly shifted because they needed the story to shift because they didn't have time. And that's a shame because of how much time they had spent on this. The last season's conclusions may be fine. I'm just not okay with how they presented them.
So you actually sold me now. Unfortunately, well, you know, I've been watching. I kind of thought in a way that they were going to, like, I didn't see how they could address enough of, like you said, what you're saying, all these characters, all these arcs, how they could do it in six episodes. But like, what
it turns out they can't.
Arya, what about her? I mean, you know,
pretty good.
Pretty good. Did we know that those two? Who is Cersei's like guard?
Oh, Gregor, the Mountain.
Yeah, were they actually brothers? Was that?
Like... Yeah. And we've been talking for years about Clegane Bowl.
Okay,
which is maybe brother versus brother.
Oh, okay.
And, like, the Hound's arc feels very complete. He showed signs over the course of his life in the show of not being quite as uncaring as he may have appeared. He right. appeared to not give a shit about anyone.
Right.
But it was clear he had a soft spot for both Arya and Sansa.
Right.
And in the end, he kind of saves Sansa's life, telling her to move on, go away, or she'll end up like him. He knew he was going to die. This was his destiny. He embraced death literally and metaphorically by grabbing onto the mountain and casting himself into the flames, which were the very thing that he'd spent his life fearing.
Right.
Because he was more intent on his revenge than he was on his fear. This is a complete story arc. But that's because it's easy to wrap up story arcs when you're talking about important secondary characters. When you're talking about Jon Snow and Daenerys and everyone else, they're so vital to the overall story. Like, the Hound is important, but he's not the story itself.
Right.
Daenerys is the actual story. Jon Snow is the actual story. For them to just cast aside everything that they've been building over seven seasons because they need to hurry up and get to the end of their arc is always going to be a disappointing thing given the pace of the show ahead of that. I could be fine with Jon Snow being weak, but can we watch him get to that point? Does he have to just suddenly be weak? It's so out of character, it's ridiculous.
Right, and Daenerys, who, you know, had started off, like you said, started off as this one who just kind of wield her power, you know, ruthlessly, and then mm-hmm. realized, okay, I need to be a leader, not just a ruler, suddenly just decides, okay, I'm just going to burn everyone alive.
Right, and they have the after-show commentary, right, where the directors are talking about it, and they're explaining what her motivations were, and I'm like... Dude.
Yeah, but you shouldn't have to explain it. If you have to explain, it's like explaining a joke. You did a bad job if you're in your little after the throne or whatever, trying to tell everyone why you made those decisions. We should know why they made those decisions. That's what character development is.
Right.
We understand why they made these decisions, and everyone's like, oh, well, that's madness. That's why she's mad. Yeah, but she has exhibited restraint and other aspects throughout the seasons when she was pushed and could have gone mad, and she's experienced, she lost her baby, and she lost, like, many other things and they were saying that, oh, she focused on what she had lost. Well, we've seen her lose things before, and she didn't burn villages and innocents down.
Right. You know, if you're going to have a consistent pathology from Daenerys about her being Mad Queen, because a lot of people are going, a lot of people must have not been paying attention to all blah, blah, blah. No, I was paying attention. Every time she did something Mad Queen in previous seasons, it was out of a misguided Thanos-like style of justice. She thought it was justice. It was always somebody bad and so on. So if she was going to burn Westeros to the ground, and if that was going to be consistent with her character, there should have been some lead up that got her to exhibit some hatred for the people of Westeros for having contributed or helped or supported the overthrowing of her family. She should have been showing that she blames them.
Right.
Instead, at the beginning of the season, she was still talking about not hurting innocents. She knew they were innocent. She still did it. This isn't consistent with her character. Not unless she's literally batshit insane, which is why I'm hoping one of the theories that's out there, which is that at the beginning of the episode, Varys is talking to that girl, and it seems apparent that he was trying to poison Daenerys. So one of the theories out there is that he was poisoning her and that she might literally be mad. And that, in fact, in season one, somebody mentions that poison is a woman's weapon. And somebody says that also a eunuch's, which, of course, Varys is, which then raises the question. Oh, well, maybe he was poisoning her and that's why she was mad. Hey, maybe he was poisoning her dad and that's why he was mad. Maybe all this time, these Targaryens weren't actually batshit insane, but instead, you know, Varys was interfering or whatever. Like, I could accept that more. But right now...
What if they...
Go ahead.
I was going to say, what if they were all just, they all just died in the plane crash on the first episode?
Oh, jeez. Is that the end of Lost? Thanks for the spoiler alert.
I'm going to start a petition to rewrite Lost.
Already did it.
Damn it.
You know, I never watched Lost, and now that I've heard so many people complain about it, I never will.
I would totally watch it all over again. But I'd rather watch Fringe, which is the better, I think, of the two series.
Well, I always talk about, you know, what series I had, like, the best ending. And people still say that they think that the Sopranos ending was one of the best, and I still think it was one of the worst of all time. I think it was the biggest cop-out. It was a cop-out ending.
Yeah.
I think the guy recently did an interview about it.
Yeah, well, that's the whole thing. It's, again, he's still talking about it. And, again, it's like you just said, if people knew what happened, you wouldn't have all the ambiguity. You know, the whole idea is, oh, well, the guy in the members only jacket came out and shot him, and that's the reason why it went black. Okay, but why? Why would that guy have shot him? There was absolutely no reason.
There was ambiguity.
It's just like what's his name, who's a great director, and obviously Inception is a great movie. And you remember when Leonardo DiCaprio spins his little thing at the end and he walks away?
Yeah.
So you don't know, is he still in the dreamscape or is he in the real world?
Oh, I know.
And the director was like, no, that's the point. You don't know.
But you do know.
Because he walked away because it was more important to see the kid. And I'm like, that's stupid. If that was me, I would care to know if the children that I'm so happy to see aren't fucking real. What parent is not going to give a shit if their kids are real? That's a dumb ending. Just tell us. Is he still in the dreamscape or
not? He's not.
Oh, Ben. He's gonna lay down some truth for you now.
Did I poke the tiger?
No, it's very it was somebody figured it out, and it was very simple. They said that whenever Leonardo DiCaprio was in a dream sequence, he had a wedding band on. When he wasn't dreaming, no wedding band. And when you see him grab his luggage at the end, near the end, he doesn't have his wedding band on.
All right, I accept that.
Okay. It's kind of now. It's stupid that the director said that. I mean, why wouldn't he just say, "Hey, look, if you watch closely, you'll be able to pick up on it," instead of saying that he ended it and ended it that way.
No, I know, and you know what? People do that all the time when they. I swear they're trying to make things that are already artistic more artistic, and right. For no reason. There will be something that's clearly happened, and they're like, well, I just want the fans to decide. Blah, 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 blah. No, yeah. Just tell us what happened. It's a story.
Did you ever see The Shield? Have you watched The Shield?
No, I didn't watch that.
Okay, so I won't give you the way the ending, because this is actually something you should probably take the time to invest and watch. But this was so Vic Mackey is this cop who is like a guy who is just like a kind of an anti-hero, but sometimes just evil. Like the first episode, and this is not a big secret, he shoots a cop in the head, you know, who's ratting on them. So that's what kind of person this guy is. And at the end of the series, you think there's only three scenarios that can happen. Number one, he gets arrested. Number two, he dies. Or number three, he gets away with it again after all this time. And you're trying to figure out what could they possibly do that doesn't come off as kind of like a cheap ending. Now, I won't say how they did it, but I thought it was absolutely perfect. They threaded that needle. It's hard to do that, to end a series in a good way, and they did it better than anyone. So,
you know, the problem that with Game of Thrones is I feel like there's been a lot of fighting, arguing, and turmoil behind the scenes between Martin and the writers. And he's already come out and written a blog and said that that's not true. And I know that Martin's come out and said, no, people have this all wrong. I'm happy with it. This is all exactly going according to plan and so on. And of course he would do that. It means nothing to me, because what I see is a show that was based on very meticulously laid out books. And forget why Martin wasn't finishing them. The point is they took over the narratives. They don't understand the characters as well as he does. They didn't have source material to run from. They did the best they could. As far as a show goes, it may have been fine, but not in comparison to the previous five seasons, which were based on the books. And so I think the huge lesson that television shows learned here is if the series isn't finished being written yet, don't start the fucking show. I mean, honestly, because the things that I could imagine happened behind the scenes, this show started 8 years ago, 9 years ago. I can imagine at that time, Martin, a procrastinator, which I understand quite a bit about, was probably telling them, don't worry, both books out will be out by the end of next year. And Martin probably totally believed that was true, and it wasn't. And they were probably beating down his door every day. Hey, we're on season three now. You going to finish those books? Hey, we're on season four now. You going to finish those books? And then when it came time to, like, the rubber was going to meet the road, they met. They talked about what to do. And I think that they had their own ideas and probably pushed back on his pushback. We're like, dude, I understand that you don't like some of the things we want to do, but you should have finished your books. And this is a show with millions of dollars invested in it at this point. We're going to take the characters where we want to. I don't think that if Martin finishes his books, which let's face it, there's a really good chance he won't, I'm not convinced that they're going to end in the same way that this is. It might have the ultimate same ending, but I'm not convinced that the arcs will follow with exactly the same kind of unfolding that they have in the show.
What do you think? What do you think is going to happen in the final episode? Any predictions?
Well, I'll give you mine. Okay. You want my hopeful prediction or what I think is actually going to happen?
What do you think is actually going to happen?
I think what's actually going to happen is that Sansa is going to be the queen.
Okay.
Jon's going to kill Dany. Grey Worm's going to kill Jon. And Arya's going to kill Grey Worm. And then Arya's going to leave on her own. Sansa's going to become queen of the Seven Kingdoms. And the show ends. I think that I'm probably missing some turn that makes that all horrible or more horrible. But what I wish would happen is that just like they talk in the show about Valyria being destroyed by the Doom, which was basically, according to, you know, the books and the way they talk about it in the show, was basically establishing that Valyria had reached heights of corruption and, horribleness. And the gods, which they've already established exist in this show, wiped them out. And what I wish would happen is that after all of this mess, it would turn out that no, Dany wasn't there to break the wheel as she had promised, because the wheel is much larger than the simple Game of Thrones. It is a lifetime wheel that goes from corruption to starting over, like, you know, population reset, shit like that. And that the show ends with everything in blood and fire.
So are you, your hope is that everyone dies at the end?
My hope is that very few people survive. Okay. And that there's a huge cataclysm. Because I also think that it would be poetic or artistic in a way. Because it would be the whole lesson that they try to express in the show. The whole lesson of Valyria is that these people were so consumed with their lust for power that they did not pay attention to the doom that was coming for them. And so if it turns out that that's exactly what happens in the show to everyone else, where they were so consumed for their lust of power that they didn't see the same exact doom coming for them, that they were basically warned would come, then it would be interesting because it would be true of the viewer too. We were so focused on that lust for power and seeing who was going to win the Game of Thrones that we ignored all the signs. And we got screwed in the end because the characters we love didn't end the way we thought it would, and everybody's dead.
There you have it. And that's going to be the last word for this episode. We went about an hour and a half. No, about an hour and 20 minutes. So, Ben, before we go, there's a great Mark Twain quote for you. Never put off till tomorrow what you can do the day after tomorrow.
I'm going to read that quote tomorrow.
There you go. Mm-hmm. Words to live by. All right, so our guest, Bridget Fetasy, where can everybody find you?
On Twitter.
She's back on Twitter. Yeah. Twitter at Bridget Fetasy. And you have a podcast. What's your podcast? Tell everyone.
Oh, it's called Walk-In's Welcome, and it's on Ricochet or any other place you find podcasts. And it's it's about grit and resilience.
Do you notice that, like, Jay, you said at the beginning of the show that Bridget's probably more well-known and popular than any of us?
Yeah.
She doesn't even, like, she almost looks, it's like she looks at letting people know where she is as a minor nuisance that she'd rather not be bothered with.
No!
You know, I know. Like,
you have to do that. Oh, please, you know where I am.
You know me. You know where I am, assholes. You figure it out.
I just live on Twitter, and I know, I mean, there's other places, but yeah, you can find me on Twitter.
No, it's exactly right. Just go find me. I don't have time to keep it for all. Just go.
Hey, news gal, Andrea Ruth, where can everyone find you?
Typically next to our 12-year-old dog, letting him out, but on Twitter too. And Android.
I sense a little passive aggression there.
No, he's just been sitting here next to the bathroom, the bathroom door to our, that's the master bathroom to our, that goes out. He's got a way to get out, but he is insistent upon getting out through our bedroom door. And
yeah, he doesn't
like
realize. Yeah, he gets stupid. He doesn't realize he can go around the way he came to get back out of the room, but he's like, no.
Yeah, so he's been clawing at the door. So, and like, I've been telling him to go around.
One time, like normally when we walk through the door, he's there waiting for us. And one time we went out, we closed the bedroom door, we left the bathroom door that leads into the bedroom open. And I was like, we walked in, he wasn't there. And when I opened the bedroom door, he was sitting behind there. He didn't realize he could just walk around and come out and greet us. He's old and stupid.
Yeah.
So that's just it. Yeah. Anyway.
So he's a boomer.
Yeah, he's a boomer dog. Yeah, well, you figure in dog years, yeah, he's 77. So he is a boomer. He's older than Trump.
Mm-hmm.
All right, and you can find Andrea also has a podcast called The Right Side.
Oh, yes.
You can find her there, and also the ARC Digital newsletter.
We're apparently all the worst marketers for our stuff.
You guys are terrible. I know. Ben, where can everyone find you? Oh, yeah.
Ben's on Twitter, too.
Ben's on Twitter, too. Ben Howe.
Go look the name up. I don't have time to do this bullshit.
And he's got his book coming out.
Yeah, it's called The Mr. Ben.
Yeah.
Go all to right. Amazon.
And you could find me. Let me get the list here. Right. No. Find me at Jay Caruso. No,
okay. It's called The Immoral Majority, and you can get it on Amazon. It's available for pre-order now. I'm going to start telling everybody it's number one in pre-orders on Amazon just to see if that gets people to pre-order it.
Yeah, so that way they pre-order it.
And one, you heard it here first. That's a bald-faced lie.
And it's, at some point, we'll be giving out an autographed copy to one lucky listener.
And if you pre-order, I will read the book to you over the phone.
There you go. All right. I'm Jay Caruso, Jay Caruso at Twitter. And you can find me at the Washington Examiner. In fact, the new issue coming out next week, I've got the cover story writing about the final Rolling Thunder. Rolling Thunder is the famous motorcycle ride that takes place here in the Capitol on Memorial Day. It's to honor POWs. And this is the final year they're doing it. They're saying they can no longer afford to keep doing it. And they said, plus the Pentagon people are being jerks about letting them use their parking lot. So you'll want to read that. Got a great cover. It's showing a bunch of bikers riding off into the sunset. Lots of fun. And if you go to my Twitter profile, you can find the link for the Monday Notice, my weekly free weekly newsletter. You can sign up for that. All right. So we will be back next week. We'll be talking about the Game of Thrones finale. I mean, we have to. It'd be kind of dumb not to talk about it. And we'll see if Ben was right. We'll see if he's still upset, if he doesn't like it. And we'll find out for sure. So we'll see you next time here on the Fifth Estate.
Thank you.
Everyone just so you know, Bridget said thank you right there at the end.